Now, if I may, I'd like to set the stage. We will be talking about specific cases from this term, but let me offer a little bit of context. There are many ways to look at the Supreme Court and tell its story, but one way to think about that story would be to think about the dialectic, the tension between presidents who over the years have tried to change the face of the court, change its direction, and the court itself. Starting with Richard Nixon, who in 1968 ran for the presidency, basically attacking the Warren Court and charging it with disregarding the needs of law-abiding Americans. He filled four vacancies on the court, including Rehnquist, who later became Chief Justice. But his efforts to remake the court were somewhat mixed. Lewis Powell, whom I've mentioned, was more of a moderate conservative, and one of the four was Harry Blackmun, who drifted fairly soon to the more liberal side of the court. Ronald Reagan, when he was president, brought with him a more ideological Justice Department under Ed Meese, and I think the effort, they stepped up the effort to really change, maybe do what Nixon had not fully accomplished. He had three vacancies on the court. You will have read about and probably seen film clips from the famous hearings with Robert Bork. That was an effort that failed. Bork was not confirmed to the court. So Reagan's appointees to the court were Nino Scalia, obviously an addition to the conservative bloc on the court, but also Justices O'Connor and Kennedy, who, though conservative, would be more centrist, more moderate conservatives. The first President Bush gave us yet another addition to the conservative bloc, Clarence Thomas, right there with Rehnquist and Scalia. But his other appointment was what they called at the time the stealth candidate, David Souter, who turned out to be something of a liberal on the court. Bill Clinton filled two seats on the court, but they were essentially moderate liberals, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer. Now, that's the story basically up to about 1994. What was then interesting was that for the next 11 years, 1994 to 2005, there were no vacancies on the Supreme Court. That's an extraordinary period of time. It's the longest period in American history, other than a period back in the early 19th century, without a vacancy on the court. So during that time, one could essentially take stock of the change that had taken place in the so-called Rehnquist Court, a long way from the Warren Court of the 1960s. The conservatives clearly had taken hold in some areas. Federalism, for example, the 10th and 11th Amendment, seemed to be given new respect on the Supreme Court. Church and state cases, there was an erosion of the wall of separation between church and state. But the conservative revolution was certainly incomplete in that the center, O'Connor in particular, to a lesser extent Kennedy, clearly mattered in holding the line on areas like Roe versus Wade, which was not overruled, areas like affirmative action, O'Connor famously writing the Grutter opinion from the University of Michigan. So at that point, if you were a conservative critic of the court's more liberal activism from, let's say, the 1960s, you thought, yes, you'd made some gains, but there was still a distance to go. Then came 2005. That was really quite an important year, because that was the year that, at the end of the term in June, Justice O'Connor announced her plans to step down, and President Bush nominated John Roberts to take her place. Well, then, unexpectedly, in September of that year, Chief Justice Rehnquist died, and so President Bush then nominated Roberts to fill that seat on the court, to become Chief Justice and not Associate Justice. You may recall that fall in September, Bush played with the idea of nominating Harriet Myers, and that didn't last. That was a short moment. By the end of the month, it was clear that that nomination wasn't going anywhere, so she withdrew. And in her place, President Bush nominated Samuel Alito, who was then confirmed in January of 2006. So the 2005-2006 term don't tell us much about the Roberts Court, because Alito took his seat halfway through the term. I think the court deliberately marked time on some important issues. And so by the summer of 2006, 2 years ago, it was not yet very clear what one might say about the Roberts Court. Now, a word about last term, not the one that just ended, but the one that ended a year ago, because by then you had all nine justices seated, Alito and Roberts both having taken their seats alongside the others. And I think if if we were met a year ago, last September, I think we would certainly say the court is now a more conservative place. That you could see the effect of Alito replacing O'Connor. Rehnquist replacing, Roberts replacing Rehnquist didn't have as much effect on the voting pattern, but Alito replacing O'Connor certainly did. That was a term in which the conservatives scored. I'm using these words kind of loosely. Forgive me for sort of journalistic jargon, because you as law students know that it's not that simple, but the labels are sometimes helpful. But in terms of conservative victories, the partial birth abortion case, the court for the first time upheld a ban on a specific method of abortion. In the area of race in schools, the court held that it was not constitutional to use race as a factor in assigning students in public schools. In the area of religion or church and state, the court held that taxpayers do not have standing to challenge, did not have standing to challenge faith-based initiatives in the White House. And there were some others that I could mention. One real exception that term, the EPA case, in which the court said that EPA does have the authority to regulate automobile emissions, and that was a case which, if you're keeping score, might seem to go the other way. It would be possible to argue a year ago that we were beginning to see the fruits of the conservative efforts to change the court. I mean, think about the interesting fact that both Roberts and Alito were young lawyers in the Reagan Justice Department in the 1980s. And so in a sense now they'd come pretty far from that day to being on the court. One thing you began to see last year, and it's interesting to try to track this pattern, was how among the four most conservative justices on the court, there seemed to be two pairs, namely Scalia and Thomas, who basically are take no prisoners, slash and burn, leave the countryside drenched in fire kind of justices. Their opinions make good reading, as you know, they in your con law course. So you've got the pair of them, the sort of, the hard right on the court. Alito and Roberts appeared to be, though conservative, more incrementalist. They were going in the same direction as Thomas and Scalia, but not as fast nor as far. They were willing to go a step at a time. Kennedy, it turned out a year ago, obviously held the fifth and critical vote. If there was a 5-4 decision that term, he was inevitably in the majority. I think he was in the among the five in every single one of the 5-4 cases that year. This produced enormous frustration on the dissenters' part. I mean, you could just feel Breyer and Ginsburg, who are not really Warren Court-style liberals, they're really moderate liberals, but you could feel their frustration seething up, for example, in their reading their opinions from the bench. There was one case in which Breyer was the school case, the Louisville and Seattle school case, in which Breyer from the bench said, it's not often in law that so many have changed so much so quickly. Just obvious frustration. So that was the term that ended a year ago. What about the term we're about to discuss? What about the 2007-2008 term? Well, one puzzling thing about the docket is that it's a shrinking docket. One wonders where the cases are going. There was a time when there would be 150 merits decisions in the Supreme Court. That has now shrunk this past term to 67 cases decided after oral argument. That's the fewest cases handed down after oral argument since the 1953-54 term. And people are a little bit unsure as to what's happening. Maybe just Chief Justice Roberts is a minimalist and sort of trying to shrink the docket. But something is happening there. If you want to look at the court in terms of which circuits take a beating, it's the Ninth Circuit. They took more cases from the Ninth Circuit than from any other, and they reversed about 80% of them. So that's 4 out of 5 that the Ninth Circuit gets batted down. There weren't as many 5-4 decisions in this term. The previous term, 1/3 of all the cases were 5-4. This term, there were fewer of those, but on the other hand, there were a decrease in unanimous decisions. Pairings are interesting. Roberts and Alito on the one side, Souter and Ginsburg on the other, and those idiosyncratic justices turns out to be Thomas, who managed to dissent by himself 4 times. Kennedy, and apparently this doesn't mind. That doesn't bother him in a bit. I think he's even questioned cases like Gibbons versus Ogden, which I thought was beyond recall at this point. Kennedy was in the majority the most of anybody in the previous term, but interesting, this was sort of slipped in rather quietly. This past term, the justice most often in the majority was Justice Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts. So that's some of the patterns and dynamics of the court. Finally, a comment on the cases, and I'll turn to my colleagues. In about, I would say, April of this year, you know, before the term really came to its conclusion, there was some impression that the court was searching for some middle ground, that the ideological lines were being somewhat blurred, that the court was finding more narrow grounds of opinion. Two cases I want to mention. One was a case in which the court upheld Kentucky's method of execution by legal injection. And the issue before the court, as they saw it, was not the question of whether whether injections are inevitably unconstitutional. It was the method of injection in the particular case that was at stake. The court splintered. There were, of the seven justices who joined the majority, there were six opinions being written. So clearly on that case, they were not prepared to reach ultimate issues. The other case that I found interesting was the voter ID case from Indiana. This has been a partisan fight in this country that Republican-controlled legislatures have been passing laws that require you to produce a voter ID. Democrats oppose those laws only with the argument that they tend to fall most heavily on poorer people or older people or people that don't have cars, don't have driver's license, and the like. But in that case, the court, instead of splitting along 5-4 lines, was 6-3. Stevens joined the more conservative justices to uphold the Indiana law, and I think it really turned on the record that the majority in the case were not convinced that there was a showing factually that in Indiana, as it's called, this law was in fact applied, that it was used in a way to be discriminatory. That was April. Well, any thought that the court would end on a non-ideological note was dispelled by the end of the term, because by the time the court stepped down in June of this year, we had some big cases, the D.C. gun control case, the case involving Guantanamo detainees, and the case involving capital punishment for those who rape children. Now, though the splits were ideological, the conservatives didn't win all those cases, as you probably know. The liberals won, if again I'm using these labels kind of loosely, the more liberal justices prevailed in the Guantanamo case, Boumediene. The third time around that the Bush administration had been rebuffed in this area in the Supreme Court. And then in the child rape case, Kennedy versus Louisiana, there was a 5-4 decision where the court, where Justice Kennedy, writing a fairly expansive opinion, held that the death penalty for child rape was unconstitutional. Now, that is something of a sense of the overview. I just tried to give you a sense of what has been happening up to this case, up to this term. And now we want to look at those particularly interesting and important cases, the ones that I've just mentioned from near the end of the term. We are being selective, as I said. And so we'll go in the following order. David Martin will talk about Boumediene. Chris Brigman will talk about the D.C. gun control case, and Richard Bonney will be talking about capital punishment. At the end of our remarks, rather than taking questions and having discussion, we will adjourn. There will be a reception. I understand that there will be food and drink lavishly laid on, but this is your chance to bankrupt the Student Legal Forum. you don't need dinner tonight. Eat their food. But I'm sure that panelists will be happy to linger for a few minutes and chat about some of these cases and others. So thank you again to the forum for making this affair possible, and I turn first to David Martin.
Thanks very much. I appreciate the invitation to be here and to talk about, to take part in this, what's become an important annual event here at the law school, to get our semester kicked off with a very useful look at what the Supreme Court did in the past year. I will be talking about the Boumediene case. It's a milestone case with regard to the writ of habeas corpus. It's the Guantanamo detainee case. Just to remind you, if your Latin's a little rusty, habeas corpus means have the body. That doesn't tell you very much about what it means. It was about until my third year of law school before I really understood what the writ of habeas corpus was all about. And I think it's in the news a lot more now. People may understand it more. But obviously, it's a procedure of great antiquity whereby a detainee can invoke the assistance of a court to look into the justification for the detention. It's a procedure whereby the court will command the one who has the body, the jailer, to come before the court and justify the ongoing detention. So it's got to be justified not just to one of the jailer's superiors, not just to somebody in the executive branch, but to somebody in an independent situation, an independent judge, and convince the judge that the detention is justified. Habeas corpus is guaranteed in the Constitution in a kind of backhanded way in the suspension clause. It says that the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless when in cases of rebellion or invasion the public safety may require it. So it's kind of a backhanded way of guaranteeing it, and a lot of controversy over exactly what is the content of this habeas corpus protection that is guaranteed in Article 1. The court held in Boumediene that the constitutional guarantee of habeas applies in Guantanamo and suggested that it probably applies even beyond Guantanamo, beyond in other places beyond our shores, where the U.S. exercises complete jurisdiction and control. It's a deeply important ruling. It preserves some very fundamental liberties, and it holds promise of a needed check on executive action in the kind of shrunken globe that we now inhabit in the 21st century, a globe where the executive may exercise coercive authority against both citizens and aliens anywhere in the world. Now, the decision, however, leaves a great many questions unanswered. And I'm going to try to summarize the decision and highlight some of those remaining questions in the brief time that I have available. But first, I want to put it in context. I think sometimes we forget how far we had already come before the Boumediene decision, say since about 2002, in reining in sweeping assertions of or sweeping impositions on individual liberty. What I want to do is to remind us how the terrain of dispute had narrowed already before we get to the controversy in Boumediene. So think back right now to immediately after 9/11, 7 years ago today, and then in that year immediately following it. Obviously, the nation wanted to respond, wanted the executive branch to respond in a major way. Congress authorized the use of military force in a way that led to our deposing the regime of the Taliban in Afghanistan, and certain other things followed from that. And the executive, in any event, made a very strong response, both militarily and in other fields, based on very broad assertions of unilateral executive power. In that process, it was bolstered by an Office of Legal Counsel at the Department of Justice, OLC, that was, at the very least, shall we say, quite creative in hastening to find ways to say yes whenever they were asked anything about the range of the executive's authority. And I would say, I would go beyond creative. That many of the memos, you probably have looked at some, you may look at some, you will look at some, I'm sure, in some of your classwork here. Many of the memos are remarkably sloppy. The initial one that justified the use of torture, although it didn't say torture, the use of harsh interrogation techniques, overlooked so many key questions that I really would have given it a very low grade as a student-authored memorandum. I mean, this is really quite shocking for those of us who've had some government experience, some Justice Department experience. OLC is traditionally an elite group, a highly respected office within the government, and you might disagree with their opinions, but you would expect really high-quality legal work. To talk about the range of executive powers in that memorandum and not to discuss the Youngstown case is quite stunning. To suggest that the president, that Congress has no authority to rein in the president's decisions about the use of interrogation techniques completely ignores express text in Article 1, Section 8, which says that Congress shall have authority to make regulations governing our land and naval forces. So it goes beyond that in any event. There are two main actions that have presented major liberty questions that were undertaken in that that began really in that year after September 11th. The first one gained the most attention initially. It was in November of 2001. The president issued an executive order which established military commissions to try and punish terrorists for violations of the laws of war and possibly of other laws as well. These cases were to be heard before tribunals with more limited procedures. They certainly were not courts martial, and they departed in many ways from the protections that had been worked out over the years to apply in court martial procedures. They were essentially to be designed from scratch. And the claim was that these would be quick, they would be flexible, they'd be able to handle classified information. We would achieve swift justice with regard to those who had attacked our country. Well, the first conviction took place about a month or two ago, so that idea didn't work too well for quick procedures using these designed from scratch military commissions. But that was one way. That attracted a lot of attention, a lot of controversy then, because there was the order was published, the president's order was published, and the cutbacks on procedures, including on judicial review, attracted a lot of hostile commentary. Now, that controversy somewhat obscured the second set of steps that raised serious questions about liberty, and I think in many ways are more troubling. This was an assertion of authority to detain enemy combatants indefinitely, not just those who were picked up on the battlefield in Afghanistan, where the focus was and the focus of Congress was in adopting the authorization of military force, but also citizens, also people picked up anywhere else in the world. Boumediene himself was an Algerian picked up in Bosnia. There was a U.S. citizen named Jose Padilla who was picked up at O'Hare Airport and was held as an enemy combatant. Not only was he picked up and held on the assertion of pure executive authority, but people in these circumstances were held basically incommunicado. The executive went to great lengths to limit the possibilities for individuals in this category to consult a lawyer, even to have contact with their family. Even those who were held in the United States, the two citizens and one alien who were held in the United States under this category. And later we learned that many of the people held as enemy combatants were subjected to various forms of cruel treatment in order to extract information. Even in that setting, even with that very bold assertion of authority to detain someone on executive authority in really troubling conditions, the executive branch's position was that no court could review these decisions to detain, or if they could review, it was under a very deferential standard of review that essentially, the executive asserted, essentially had to accept an affidavit by a fairly low-level individual in the Defense Department as conclusive on the facts as they applied to the case. Now, these were really stunning assertions of very sweeping authority, and I've often marveled at the people who did it. I mean, many of them very well-intentioned and quite understandably deeply troubled by what we had experienced on September 11th, the kind of attack, these new kinds of threats, and we didn't know in 2001 and 2002 just how wide it might be or how many more attacks might be coming. Remember, there was not only September 11th, but there was the anthrax scare as well. So I understand the drive that we've got to do something, and we've got to be bold and creative in doing that, but I marvel at the poverty of imagination displayed by some of those involved, particularly in justifying this indefinite detention of people the executive branch would label an enemy combatant. They were so convinced that they would use this authority only against cutthroat terrorist enemies of the United States that they couldn't see how easy it would be to misuse that very procedure if it were held to be valid against others. They seemed to forget that we once had a president who had an enemies list. And it wasn't enemies overseas, it was political enemies. They were called enemies, so why couldn't they be called enemy combatants and maybe detained on that basis? Or they couldn't see, it seemed to me, the very real risk that these procedures would be misused against individuals, maybe foreigners, picked up in questionable places, but individuals who were completely innocent and be subjected to all this without any reasonable access to a way to establish that they were not dangerous terrorists. By the time of the Boumediene case came to the Supreme Court, many checks had been applied to these procedures, and the Supreme Court had played a significant role in doing that. In 2004, the Supreme Court decided a case called Hamdi versus Rumsfeld. This was one of the citizens who had been detained. He had actually been picked up on the battlefield under circumstances that seemed to make it more justified than just picking up somebody at a U.S. airport. Nonetheless, the court reviewed it. It said there was it was important that courts provide some kind of review, and the Hamdi court decreed minimum due process standards to be applied there. The individual had to have an opportunity to contest his designation as an enemy combatant before a neutral decision maker. And after that case, the administration responded, and here was one time when they didn't just respond in a totally narrow and grudging way. They applied essentially what they saw as that set of procedures prescribed by Hamdi, not just to the citizens that were detained, but to anyone who was detained. They set up what were called combatant status review tribunals, CSRTs, to provide a forum where the individual could say, well, wait a minute, I'm not one of those who fits the standards for an enemy combatant. I shouldn't be detained. A lot of questions have been raised about the adequacy of those standards. In fact, that's one of the issues in Boumediene, the adequacy of the procedures in the CSRTs. But it was a huge improvement over this kind of procedureless wasteland that existed before that, where your only chance to say, I'm not the guy, I'm not dangerous, was essentially to make that case to your interrogator, the same guy who was keeping you shackled to the floor in 50 degree, in a room that was kept at 50 degrees. And the CSRTs that were set up found, I believe it was 38 individuals who did not meet the definition of enemy combatants, and they were cleared for release. There were delays in their ultimate release, and some maybe they're still trying to figure out exactly where they can go. Second case that brought in some improvements in 2004 was Rasool versus Bush, which construed the habeas corpus statute to say that it applies to Guantanamo. It wasn't a constitutional ruling. He said some things about the Constitution, but the statute applies to Guantanamo, so people who are detained there can ask a U.S. federal court to consider the validity of the detention. These were somewhat narrow rulings. They left room. They invited Congress to respond, and Congress did step in the Detainee Treatment Act, set certain standards for the conditions of confinement, and then went ahead and overruled Rasool. Said, okay, that's a statutory ruling. We're now amending the statute. Habeas doesn't apply in Guantanamo. But again, it was useful to have that dialogue because Congress said, well, we're not going to push this to the fullest extent. We're going to create an alternative avenue for judicial review. You go through your CSRT procedure, or you go through your military tribunal procedure, and then you can go to the District of Columbia Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit and contest that, but according to a somewhat narrow standard of review. Did the procedures conform to the Secretary of Defense's statement of procedures? And to the extent that law and Constitution apply, were those rights honored? So there were limits on judicial review. The Supreme Court construed those very technically in the next case in 2006, the Hamdan case, where they said, well, we have jurisdiction. It was a challenge to the military commissions as set up under that November 2001 order by President Bush. And the court said, well, we don't find that this has been authorized by statute. And implicitly, they said, you didn't have independent authority on your own, Mr. President, to establish these as just a matter of executive decree. Therefore, the commissions as established are invalid, and they said an important part of the Geneva Conventions, Common Article 3, will apply even to these detainees in this kind of unusual war that we're fighting against terrorism. Now, again, the court said, look, this is a narrow ruling. We're saying the statute doesn't, no statute authorizes these kinds of procedures. It goes back to Congress. The president can do that. The president should take this to Congress. If the president's going to exercise this kind of authority, persuade Congress to do that. And you might have expected a really good debate in Congress then over these highly contentious issues. We didn't have it. President Bush set up the situation in such a way that he essentially insisted in early September that Congress give him new authority to have military commissions operate and to get it done before the elections. And essentially, he brought Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and other very dangerous individuals finally to Guantanamo and essentially said, I dare you to deny me the power to try these individuals. I dare you to wait until after this election to consider that kind of issue. So Congress passed a statute. They did, in that process, somewhat tighten the bars to habeas corpus jurisdiction or other judicial review, other than that in the D.C. Circuit. So that's the setting in which the Boumediene case came to the Supreme Court. By a 5-4 vote, this was one of those 5-4 decisions, with Justice Kennedy writing for the majority, the court held that habeas corpus applies as a matter of the Constitution. The Constitution requires that habeas corpus apply in a setting like Guantanamo and possibly beyond, where the United States exercises full jurisdiction and control. They looked at the history of the writ and essentially said, well, that's inconclusive, and they went beyond that and suggested strongly that, although they didn't quite hold this, that maybe the writ isn't just defined by the contours it had assumed in 1789. Take that, Justice Scalia. It might actually evolve in light of changing conditions in the world and in our constitutional structure. And Justice Kennedy emphasized at several points that it's a flexible writ, that we will apply a kind of functional analysis to see where it should apply and in what circumstances. Now, having said that, so the Constitution applies. Rasul was only a statutory ruling, but the Constitution also requires habeas. But it does, the suspension clause doesn't require the habeas corpus writ exactly. Congress can step in with an adequate and provide an adequate substitute. So the next question is it an adequate substitute, this review available in the D.C. Circuit after a CSRT has ruled or after a military commission has ruled? The court said no, that procedure is not enough. There's not quite as ample a scope of review as a habeas court would have, and especially the court has to have the authority to be able to hear new evidence and to make certain findings of fact based on what's submitted to the court. Now, if that applies to all kinds of administrative procedures where there's been some fact-finding by an administrative body and then the court gets to rehear all that and entertain new evidence, that would actually be quite revolutionary as a matter of administrative law and judicial review. So the court pulls back a little bit and says, well, wait a minute, that's only because of the limits that already exist on the CSRT process, the administrative process already there to consider whether the person is legitimately found an enemy combatant. If that were more ample, then maybe the habeas court wouldn't have to have that, but there are limits. So maybe there would be less scope for court review in a situation where there's initially a more traditional adversarial procedure. So the substitute is inadequate. Habeas must be available as a matter of constitutional right to individuals in these circumstances, and the matter is remanded to the lower courts, and a lot of talk about concerns that we have to step in now because these people have been detained for so long. Well, I expect we'll see a lot more in the way of delays because there are some very big questions that remain open. I think we're on the road to resolving them, just as we've come a long way now already in establishing the framework. I think these will be resolved. For example, what procedures are required for preventive detention? The court seems to say preventive detention of some kind is okay, by analogy to prisoners of war, but some kinds of procedures are required. And Justice Kennedy, it's a really interesting ruling. He seems to say maybe we're not quite demanding enough in the Hamdi case and the procedures that will be required. Maybe that's all the due process requires. Maybe the habeas corpus clause itself has its kind of its own set of minimum procedures, and they may actually require more than what Hamdi found to be required under the due process clause. Matters such as right to counsel, detainees' access to evidence against him, and an ability to confront adverse witnesses. And then the second big question is, well, what exactly are the appropriate standards for who is an enemy combatant? We still haven't really quite resolved that. What do you have to find to be able to say this person is sufficiently dangerous that they could be detained indefinitely under these circumstances? Well, those are large questions. I expect the Supreme Court will have to revisit these issues in a few years in order to settle them. Thank you.
While Chris is coming up, there are plenty of seats up in front if you all would like to be comfortable. So why don't you take a second and take some of these seats, and then we'll proceed.
Okay, well, I wanted to thank the Student Legal Forum for inviting me to this Supreme Court roundup. Those of you who have had me for constitutional law know that on occasion I've advocated a somewhat more forceful version of a Supreme Court roundup, but I'll have to content myself with the one we've got. Now, I'm here to talk about District of Columbia versus Heller. This is a case where a special policeman in D.C. What's a special policeman? It's kind of a security guard, essentially, that is deputized by D.C., and they get to carry a gun as long as they stay in the building they're securing. But this is a special policeman. Sues the District of Columbia, saying that the Second Amendment to the United States Constitution is violated by the District of Columbia's handgun and generally gun control law. So what's this gun control law about? Let me just give you a little bit of factual background, and then I'm gonna talk about the various opinions. Okay, so factual background. DC has a gun control act that requires registration of all firearms, and then basically says handguns will not be registered. Right, so through that mechanism, you have a complete ban on firearms. Now, it's true that the chief of police can give a license in certain special circumstances to get a handgun, but it's a virtual null set. So handguns effectively banned, and for the guns that remain long guns, if you keep them in your home, they have to be secured with a trigger lock or kept unloaded and disassembled. Okay, so what was the challenge? The challenge to the law was twofold. First of all, it was violative of the Second Amendment to ban handguns as a category of weapons. And second, it was violative of the Second Amendment to have this trigger lock requirement, because the trigger lock requirement essentially made lawful uses of a gun like home defense practically impossible. Right? So this is the kind of twofold challenge to the DC law. Okay. Now, I want to go through the opinions, but a couple of notes before I do. First, the slip opinion I read was 159 pages of opinions. So if I go through each and every twist and turn in these things, you know, we're all going to be dead long before I get through it. So I will confine myself to some of the highlights or the lowlights, depending on your perspective. Another caveat, there's two ways, roughly, to talk about these opinions. The one is what impact they will have on policy. The second is their methodology, right? What do they say about the interpretive methodology of the court? So I'm going to confine myself to the second, in part, and this may sound a little uncaring, but frankly, I don't care much about the policy in the following way. So I guess I'm skeptical, right, of the ability of gun control, local gun control, to do much, right? DC can ban handguns, but Virginia exists more or less to supply the black market in that territory. So the local gun control scheme is likely to be mostly ineffective. And even if we had local gun control schemes kind of spread around such that market were essentially sewn up, or a national gun control regime, the black market in guns just seems to me, as someone who generally respects markets, the black market in guns seems to me to be more like the cockroach of markets, right? It's entirely impossible to wipe out. Guns are small, they're cheap, there's tons of them kind of roaming around, they're very durable, right? And so it's unlikely, it seems to me, that gun control as a policy is really going to make that much of a dent in crime over time, that there's lots of ways that we can attack the problem of crime that would probably yield more benefits in terms of the amount of work we put into the regulation versus gun control. So that I don't oppose it, but I guess I just don't see it as particularly useful. So with that said, it's kind of easy for me, you know, and I'm sure this view may not be widely held, but it's somewhat easy for me to kind of abstract myself away from the policy questions and focus on the interpretive questions. And once you do that, it seems to me that this opinion is a kind of an interpretive playground. I mean, there's lots of stuff going on here, which I at least find interesting, and I hope you will as well. So this is a 5-4 decision, yet another one, and the majority opinion is written by Justice Scalia, and, you know, whenever I see his name on a majority, I immediately read it. You know, it's always interesting, even if I don't agree with it. So Scalia writes for himself, Justices Thomas, Roberts, Alito, and Kennedy, right, the five. Justice Stevens dissents, a dissent joined by Justices Souter, Ginsburg, and Breyer. And then Justice Breyer writes a separate dissent for reasons I'll get to. Okay. So, Second Amendment. a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Once more, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, textually, the Second Amendment is very unusual in the Constitution in that it has this kind of interrelated clause structure. The first clause, Justice Scalia labels the prefatory clause. What's the prefatory clause? A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state? Stop. Second clause, Justice Scalia labels the operative clause. What's that clause? The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Okay, so first methodological move that Justice Scalia makes is he takes this piece of text and he divides it in two. Okay, and this isn't, he's not the first to do this, but it's an interesting methodological move. And it's particularly interesting when you see what he does next, which is he goes right to the operative clause. And he says, well, what does this mean? This operative clause, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, just forget for a moment that I told you about the Second Amendment, and imagine you looked at a constitution of, you know, the United States of America, and it said, Amendment 2, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And someone asked you, okay, so that's Amendment 2, does that create an individual right to bear arms? And the answer would probably be yes, right, because that would be the only thing you saw. There would be very little confusion attending your interpretation of this, at least in terms of the quality of the right. And you would probably conclude that that amendment, the amendment we don't have, right, but the operative clause, which Justice Scalia interprets separately as the first part of his majority opinion, that guarantees some individual right to bear arms. Okay. So there's, in a sense, an interpretive move here that takes Justice Scalia, I think, just logically in the direction he wants to go, right? Because the first thing he does is he says, if we look at the operative clause, it guarantees an individual right to bear arms. The question that leaves kind of hanging is, well, why would we look at the operative clause in isolation, right? The integrated reading of this text is as a piece of text that has two clauses, each of which might inform the meaning of the other and which might have a meaning as a whole. But that's not the way he does it. He severs these two things. First, he looks at the operative clause. Okay, so getting down a little bit, drilling down a little bit. Operative clause, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So what does the right of the people mean? Right, that's the first question. And Justice Scalia says the use of the phrase the people, right, in the Second Amendment refers to all the people individually. Why? Because the phrase the people occurs in some other places in the Constitution, so the Assembly and Petition Clause of the First Amendment and the Fourth Amendment's search and seizure provision, right? There, the phrase, the people, occurs, and First Amendment rights, like right to petition, and Fourth Amendment rights, rights to be free from search and seizure, are canonically conceived of as individual rights, and so when we see the words, the people, we know, if we look at those other occurrences, that the framers meant, the framers were consistent, they meant an individual right held individually by all of the people. So that's his readings of the word the people. Now, I'm gonna give his explanation, and then so I'm also gonna give the critique, right? And some of these critiques coming up in the defense, the dissent, some of these critiques are mine, but I want to keep the critiques close to the piece of text he's interpreting just so we keep straight what we're talking about. So one critique is the people occurs in other places too in the Constitution. So for example, the preamble, we the people, or Section 2 of Article 1, which determines how people are elected to the House of Representatives, or the 10th Amendment. And in all of these cases, the people is used in a way that refers to the people as a whole, not as individuals, right? Rights retained by the people, right? That's the part of the 10th Amendment that he doesn't really talk much about. Now, he kind of brushes this aside. He says, well, look, you know, the preamble, the 10th Amendment, or Article 1, Section 2, these are not grants of rights. These are structural arrangements or statements about sovereignty. Well, so what? Right? Why would we think that the founders, the framers, would use the construction, the people, differently when they're talking about rights than when they're talking about structural elements of the Constitution? I can put the critique another way. Why, and probably a better way, why would we assign to the framers this level of coherence in their use of the phrase the people? That is, they have an understanding of the people when that phrase is used in the term of in the context of the grant of rights. They have an understanding of the term the people when that phrase is used in the context of some structural statement or some statement about sovereignty. This assigns to the framers a degree of kind of linguistic intentionality and coherence that is crazy, right? I mean, optimistic about the genius of these people, but I think maybe a little over-optimistic. Okay, so that argument, a little weak. Okay, so back to the operative clause. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. We talked about what the people are. Well, what about to keep and bear arms? Well, here Justice Scalia takes that phrase and he says, let's break it up, right? And let's break it up to keep arms, to bear arms. Let's break it up and let's understand what those phrases would have meant to people at the time of the founding, to like smart, well-educated, normal people at the time of the founding. Note, Justice Scalia has shifted his originalism here, okay? Justice Scalia's originalism back a term ago, two terms ago, focused on the understandings of the framers and ratifiers of the text. That's the kind of old originalism. The new originalism that we see in this opinion, it's not the understandings of the framers and ratifiers of the text, it's the understandings of the people to whom the text is addressed. Interesting. It's a strategic retreat, I think, from the old originalism that is responding to some criticisms of the understandings of the framers and ratifiers. Whether the strategic retreat is actually a retreat to more well-defended territory, I'll get to later. But I just wanted to plant that. Okay, so to keep arms, to bear arms. Justice Scalia says, well, look, to the people at the time of the framing to whom this text was addressed, the meaning of to keep arms is not simply to keep arms for military purposes, it's also to keep arms for other purposes, right? Hunting, self-defense, target shooting, whatever. To bear arms, the meaning of the term to people at the time of the founding was not simply to bear arms in military confrontations or to bear arms as some incident of military service. It is wider than that. It is to bear arms for many purposes, to bear arms in the course of hunting or in the course of self-defense. So these interpretations of to keep and to bear arms are pointing in a certain direction. That is, this isn't just about the militia, right, which is part of the prefatory clause, which I'll get to in a moment. This is about individual use of arms broadly. Now, the operative clause, you know, and I'm adopting this terminology, does not say the right of the people to keep arms and to bear arms shall not be infringed. It says the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And you know, as speakers of English, that typically when terms like keep and bear are associated with this conjunction and, this often suggests that these concepts are related, right? They are related in a bigger concept, to keep and bear arms. So what's the meaning of to keep and bear arms to people? That consolidated, integrated phrase, to people at the time of the founding. This Justice Scalia doesn't spend much time on, but he says there are historical examples of the use of the phrase to keep and bear arms that are consistent with the use of weapons for other than military activities. Okay, problem. There are many more historical examples of the phrase to keep and bear arms that use the phrase as being directed toward the use of arms for military activities. Right? So his historical reading of the understanding, right, that ordinary people have at the time of to keep and bear arms suggests that, well, it's consistent, right, with this broader purpose, but probably the preponderant historical reading, or at least an equal historical reading, is that it's often used in this military context, right? So the amount of interpretive traction he gets with this parsing of keep and bear arms, limited. Not empty, but limited. Okay. That's the operative clause. Conclusion on the operative clause guarantees an individual right. Right? Now, of course, you know, this biases the result a little bit, because the question then is, let's turn to the prefatory clause, he says, and see if it limits the right that's otherwise guaranteed to individuals. Right? So he's kind of ratcheted himself up a little bit by finding that this operative clause guarantees an individual right. Okay, so what about the prefatory clause? Okay, prefatory clause, again, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, right? Severed from the rest. Okay, first, what does militia mean? Well, here Justice Scalia has a very particular conception of the term militia. And to him, the militia at the time of the founding would have been understood by ordinary people as the body of all able-bodied males able to engage in common defense. Was it a creature of the state? No. It was a creature that preceded the state. It was not something the Constitution created. It's something the Constitution presumed to exist. That is, this kind of body of males physically able to engage in self-defense. Common defense. These males had militia weapons that they kept at home. These militia weapons were just their personal weapons. Right? This is the concept of militia that Justice Scalia uses. Okay, what about well-regulated? Right? This militia is said to be well-regulated. Justice Scalia says, and I quote, "This implies nothing more than the imposition of proper discipline and training." Question, by whom? Not the state. This isn't a state-regulated militia. This is the militia. Right? So left unanswered is this question, who disciplines the militia? What about the phrase necessary to the security of a free state? Does the word state mean state like New York? Or does the word state mean polity, right? The broader political community. Justice Scalia says it's the latter. It's the polity. Remember, this is not a state institution, the militia. This is a kind of pre-state institution. This is a common law institution, right? Not regulated directly by the state. Not necessary to the security of the state as a state in the United States, but a state as the polity. Okay. So what does this point toward? Well, the relationship between the two clauses is where Justice Scalia ends up. And he says, look, the first clause, the prefatory clause, does not limit the right that's granted in the operative clause. It merely tells you what the purpose is of the right. And what's the purpose? Historically, the English tyrants, when they wanted to aggrandize themselves, saw a threat from the militia, this kind of, right, this body of men able to engage in the common defense. And how did they destroy the militia? Not by banning the militia, but by banning private possession of weaponry, right? And so what's the purpose of the Second Amendment, says Justice Scalia? You can see this in the text. The purpose is to prevent the disestablishment of the militia by preventing the confiscation of the weapons on which the militia depends. Okay, so that's the upshot. Given that interpretation, DC gun ban struck down. Why? Banning a category of weapons, weapons that are of the type, right, used in the home for otherwise lawful purposes, of the type that would have been used by those engaging in militia activities, this banning cannot stand. As far as the trigger locks goes, look, the statute doesn't even give an exception, Justice Scalia says, for use of the weapon in an emergency situation. You still actually have to have the trigger lock on, which seems kind of like an uncharitable interpretation of the statute. But look, he's not looking to avoid a constitutional question. He's looking to get to one, right? So he interprets the statute as having no emergency escape hatch, and he says the self-defense, right, that is protected by the Second Amendment is made inoperable by this trigger lock provision. That goes down too. Now, he finishes his opinion by saying, look, Second Amendment guarantees an individual right, but it's not the case that all bets are off, right? It's not the case that everything goes. Regulations like no handguns for felons, or no handguns for the insane, or no handguns in schools, stand, right? Doesn't really explain why, but they stand. Okay, so that's the upshot. I'm out of time. Let me just leave you with a few remarks. So Justice Stevens' dissent, a lot of the arguments I've stated are in his dissent. He basically views the purpose of the amendment as guaranteeing, essentially, the maintenance of the state militia, right? Personal individual rights are limited, right? It's not that they aren't individual, they are, but they're limited to those uses and the possession of guns necessary for participation in the militia, right? So uses of guns for self-defense, not a militia purpose, regulable. Couple of points. I'm going to limit it to one since I'm out of time. The militia. That body of men able to participate in the common defense. Did it ever exist? Right? If it did, it didn't exist for long, right? So by 1901, for example, Congress organized the National Guard, which is not a militia, right? It's a professional armed force. What's really happened, I think, in the Second Amendment is that the intents of the framers have become completely anachronistic, right? They put in some kind of protection, right, of weaponry ownership to ensure the continuation of something that, despite all their intents, is dead. Now, this highlights a really interesting question about judicial review. Do we announce an individual right, a fairly broad individual right, to own guns based on our desire to protect something that can't really be protected, that is, the existence of the militia? Right? If the purposes that the framers were pursuing are just irretrievably lost, what do we do? Right? And what Justice Scalia has done is that he's tried to keep faith, admirably so, with the framers' purposes. But sometimes you just can't keep faith, right? Sometimes there's nothing to revive. So I look at this opinion as a very strong exercise of the power of judicial review in pursuit of something that probably was a dream, and in any event, is certainly one now. Thanks very much.
All right, my assignment is to talk about the Supreme Court's death penalty decisions this term. And what I'd like to do is to begin with a descriptive account of what the two cases that I'm going to focus on actually decided, both of which were mentioned earlier by Professor Howard. Then I want to make some general observations about the court's death penalty jurisprudence and how I think the cases that we're talking about actually fit in. If I run out of time, that's fine. The third thing, if I get to it, will be actually to look specifically at the child rape decision and say a few words about the court's decision and what it might portend. So the two cases of interest relate to what are essentially the two prongs of the doctrine in the Eighth Amendment, which prohibits cruel and unusual punishments. One is the original, really original, intention to ban certain types of punishment that were regarded as, even in centuries ago, as unacceptable, such as drawing and quartering people in connection with executing them. The other, a more recent, dating from the decision at the end of the 19th century, is to ban punishments that, even though the punishments themselves might not be inherently cruel and unusual, are excessive in relation to the crime for which the person is being punished, grossly disproportionate to the seriousness of the offense. The case on the first is the case involving the use of lethal injection. and the court 7-2 rejected a challenge to the standard protocol that is used to kill someone through lethal injection. A couple of words about the protocol. The first drug basically is given to depress the central nervous system. It's basically a barbiturate, and it's designed to cause unconsciousness. The second drug, once unconsciousness is caused, is then designed to paralyze the person's muscles, and then the third stops the heart. One of the questions in the background is, so why is the paralysis drug used? And it seems the most likely reason for this is that if you didn't do that, the person might, there would be involuntary, obviously, unconscious movements of the body, which would be sort of demean, if you will, the kind of the dignity of the, you know, of the process. So that's designed basically to keep the person still while you kill them. So the problem that was claimed here is that there's a risk through improper administration of the first drug that the person could actually be have not fully lost consciousness, and during and then they are paralyzed, so there's no way for them to express the fact that they are still conscious and experiencing pain, and indeed suffocation, which could occur. And that, everyone agreed, if that happened, that would be cruel or unusual punishment. So the claim was that because of the possibility that that might happen, which also everyone conceded could happen if you didn't administer the right amount, that there was a risk with this procedure that people would be experiencing a significant pain. And the argument then was, so therefore you have to declare this procedure unconstitutional, at least unless you have safeguards built in, or indeed that the state should show that should use an alternative protocol that didn't involve this risk. The court basically 7-2 said, well, you have no evidence that actually in Kentucky that this is actually being administered in a way that there's any indication that it's ever been administered in an improper way. One of the things that was really got the press attention was, and that the court split in all the ways that Dick said, is what are the implications of what the court said in the plurality opinion for future litigation around this? Is this just going to go on, you know, because of course there always might be evidence in state A that might bear on what happens in state B. Of course the doctors don't want to participate, or in fact it's unethical to participate in this. So you have a risk of improper administration that just comes from the fact that the anesthesiologists, who the best ones to be able to make these judgments, aren't participating, you know, at all. So that's what kind of got the attention. As I said, it was 7-2 that the court basically upheld the protocol, and in effect, I think for the most part, doesn't want to deal with this issue anymore. And that's not surprising. What is actually, for the larger purpose, most interesting about this case is Justice Stevens's concurrence. He concurred, right, in terms of whether the evidence that had been introduced, warranted invalidating the Kentucky procedure or requiring a further hearing on it. But he actually went further and expressed his view, I think to the surprise of many people who took this case the occasion to do it, to say that he actually thinks the death penalty is now, if we were starting from scratch today, should be regarded as forbidden by the Eighth Amendment altogether. Right. So that's actually the interesting thing about that case. The second case is the child rape case. The court said 5-4, with Justice Kennedy writing the opinion and having the pivotal vote, the death penalty is unconstitutionally excessive for the rape of a child. The court basically made it clear in the course of the opinion that there is a bright line rule forbidding the death penalty for crimes against individuals except for murder. And of course, because of the way the statutes have to be constructed, it's actually a subcategory of murders that are the most aggravated. And so for crimes against the individual, nothing other than murder will do. The court also made it clear, however, that for espionage, terrorism, and directing organized criminal activity, they referred to the term drug kingpins, could be punishable by death, but those are not crimes against individuals. So that's basically the kind of the take-home sort of doctrinal line there. The question that the court addressed here, the death penalty for rape of a child, was explicitly left open by the Supreme Court in 1977, almost 30 years ago, when it invalidated in a 7-2 decision the death penalty for rape of an adult woman. But there were actually there were dicta in the case that pointed in the direction of the bright line kind of approach that the court actually took here. But it was clear that the issue was reserved, and I think that is a matter of some common agreement. Now, the dicta in the case turned out to be important because a lot of people assumed that there was a bright line rule and that this was not, even though the issue was technically open, that the court would in fact decide the case the way that this case turned out to be decided. All right, so that's the descriptive account here. Now, the general observations I want to make are these. The death penalty, I think, is basically an albatross for the Supreme Court and has been since 1976 when it chose to uphold sort of existing generation of statutes. In 1972, the court, in a series of opinions that took up the entire volume of the U.S. reports, with all justices writing, struck down the generation of capital punishment statutes that was in effect in 1972. This is Furman versus Georgia. States, 35 states, in the wake of those many decisions that seemed, who knew exactly where they pointed, reenacted the death penalty, and I won't go into the details of the different ways that they did it, but in 1976, a majority of the court, 7-2, upheld at least some of those statutes and basically, you know, rejected the view that the death penalty was inherently unconstitutional. The court basically had three choices there, or the individual justices in taking their views. I mean, they could have said, no more death penalty, we're going to invalidate all these statutes and, you know, then invite the possibility of constitutional amendments and, you know, whatever other criticisms might have occurred in institutional tensions. They could, on the other hand, have basically said, well, this generation of statute gets rid of the problem that we thought existed in Furman in terms of freakish and arbitrary imposition of the death penalty. We'll uphold this generation of statutes, and then it's just basically going to, you know, be pretty much the same kind of level of review that we would give to any criminal case. Or they could do what they actually did, which was to adopt some position in the middle that basically is based on the death is different principle. Okay, so I'm just going to call this the death is different program or project. And that basically meant that the court was going to have to enunciate a whole range of different principles and doctrines that would govern the administration of capital sentencing. And that's what they've been up to since basically 1976. 1977, Coker was kind of one step in that process of saying that there are going to be certain, you know, even though the death penalty is not inherently cruel and unusual, there are going to be certain offenses for which it is grossly disproportionate. And the proportionality sort of theme of the Eighth Amendment is pretty much limited to the death penalty, right? So it's a fairly, you know, it's fairly uniquely applicable to the death penalty, and the child rape case is just another step in that. Now, I think if you just put yourselves in the sort of, you know, mind frame, I think, of any of the individual justices, any of them, regardless of, you know, their, you know, your particular views of constitutional methodology, your views about interpretation of the Eighth Amendment, or indeed your views about the death penalty. I think none of these cases, over 30 years with various justices that have sat there, provide any satisfaction. Okay? I mean, I feel like maybe some of the other cases that we talked about today, that at least the judges in the majority, you know, would feel that they did a good day's work, and that maybe they are vindicating important rights that are at stake, and the First or Second Amendment vindicating the framers' intent or standing up for the great writ. Or regardless of whether you're in the majority of the dissent, you kind of do a good day's work by thinking through a difficult question. Right, you would go home and say, well, that was, you know, good day, I'm glad to be a justice of the Supreme Court. I am absolutely confident that nobody gets any satisfaction out of thinking about viewing these records or thinking about these capital cases. It's a tar baby. And I think also It has produced sloppy and highly unsatisfying jurisprudence, okay, the effort that's been undertaken, and has yielded the all-too-predictable divisions. It's unfortunate that these divisions, the 5-4 division that we've got here, the 4-4-1 division that we have here, is replicated in other parts of constitutional interpretation. But from the beginning, it has produced, you know, a highly polarized sort of approaches to these death penalty cases, and they're, as I said, all too predictable, and, you know, they're just, none of the opinions are ever very satisfying on either side. But having said all that, I don't think they had any choice except to muddle through on this. They have no exit strategy to deal with it, and I think are essentially trapped, you know, in an unsatisfactory situation, and continue to be trapped. First of all, political support for the death penalty is eroding somewhat in recent years, I think largely because of the concerns about innocence problems, but not only that. But it's not going to disappear, so it's not going to be one of those situations, well, they just hold on long enough, the political process will get rid of this, right, reducing the need for the court to play any significant role in what happens with regard to the death penalty. I think another thing, by the way, that is relevant to the political context and that concerns, I know, Justice Kennedy and some of the other justices as well, is the embarrassment that the death penalty is to the United States on the international legal stage and as well as the, you know, broader international human rights, you know, stage. And that's kind of found its way into the opinions. But again, notwithstanding all of that, unless there is some the international pressure, and so embarrassing that it kind of forces, you know, to changes in domestic law, I just don't foresee it happening. You know, there are still 36 states, you know, that have the death penalty. But I don't think the court can abandon the Death is Different project either, because I think it's a genuine constitutional problem. This is not like other problems that have received attention in the court, where the court basically could have just stayed out of it, you know, and you're arguing about whether they've kind of asserted, you know, prerogatives for the court and brought things into the prerogative of the court that didn't belong there, such as issues relating to abortion, for example. That's not true here. I think this is a genuine constitutional problem. The court needed to pay attention to this because all the blemishes on our system of criminal justice and the imperfections of all human institutions, including the administration of criminal justice, are magnified, of course, when you're dealing with capital cases. And in addition, we have this very difficult and ugly history of racial disparities in the administration of criminal justice generally, and it's certainly been true in the administration of capital punishment. And I think that if there was any reason to do something about it in 1972, basically that was it. And yet, and of course, these problems, I won't get into all the empirical evidence, but you know, all these problems continue. So there's real reasons that the Supreme Court should be paying attention to this, and they can't just disappear, right? So I don't think they have a choice in that sense. Another part of the problem I think that they confront is that all the humane values that are at the heart of the Eighth Amendment in terms of, you know, protecting individual human dignity are basically at war with the death penalty. So to give two examples, in the death penalty jurisprudence, one thing that the court has said is that every defendant who is facing the death sentence has to be given an opportunity for an individualized determination of the suitability of the death penalty for him or her, and has to have an opportunity to offer all evidence in mitigation so that, in effect, if the way I think about it, he can say, I understand I did a horrible thing, but don't execute me and let me explain why to you. And the tremendous latitude for individualized determinations, rather than viewing the person as an undifferentiated part of the category of people who do bad things. You're going to execute this person. You know, true that we want to deter, you know, the crime, and we want to have retribution for people, you know, for crimes like this in proportion to the seriousness of the crime. But you're executing an individual human being, right? So the court, I think, had to say that. It also had to say that that what legislatures have done is to try to take the horror out of the death penalty, and that's of course what the three drug protocol case was about, right? Well, every step you make in the way of humanizing the death penalty and individualizing it reduces the certainty with which it's going to be applied and reduces the horror of the penalty, right? So everything that you're doing basically is at war with the deterrent and retributive purposes of the death penalty. And this is just part of having the death penalty, you know, in the modern world, and the court basically is caught, you know, in between in terms of its jurisprudence. So I think everything that I've just said explains why it has been the case from 1972 onward that justices who migrate to the left, okay, on the death penalty issues. Most famously, some become abolitionists. Okay, that happened to Justice Marshall and Brennan. They just, after 1972, they would not vote for the administration of the death penalty in any case. Justice Blackmun began right of center, okay, and migrated gradually to the left, and then I think it was in 1990, basically said, I'm not doing this anymore. I am not going to tinker around with the machinery of death, right? I mean, he had seen enough of it to know that this was an imperfect practice and that it should be abolished, right? So he said, I'm not going to vote for it anymore. One question is whether Justice Stevens, he said, I would not vote for the death penalty if basically the 1976 decisions, you were starting anew. I mean, he said, I'm not going to, vote in the against or in the face of a precedent. So he's kind of left it uncertain, basically, how he's going to translate his abolitionist sentiment now into individual decisions. And Justice Stevens is interesting because he was the principal architect, basically, or one of the principal architects with Justice Powell and Justice White of the death is different strategy that I described. And yet he basically says, if I were writing on a clean slate now, I would abolish it. Now, even if they don't become abolitionists, the justices move to the left on this issue. Justice White was one of them who voted to uphold all the death standard statutes in 1972. And then, was in the death is different camp in 1976. Justice Powell moved to the left on these issues, Justice O'Connor, and now basically the transformation is occurring with Justice Kennedy. So, you have to sit back and think, well, why does that happen, right, in these cases? And undoubtedly, would make a prediction, even with some who are now the new justices, I think over time, right, I think they will probably migrate a little bit more to the left on these issues than they might otherwise have thought. All right, so should I stop here, or do you want me to go into it? What's my time situation? Okay, I can do that. All right, so I want to just talk now about the child rape case. What the court basically said, 5-4 with the majority opinion. I'm really going to talk about Justice Kennedy's opinion. And there were actually, this is interesting, there were only two opinions in this case, right? There was the opinion by Justice Kennedy for the 5-member majority, and then there was an opinion by Justice Alito, if I remember correctly, in dissent. No matter how aggravated, okay, a rape is not punishable by death. Now, in reaching that conclusion, there's kind of a standard methodology that the court applies in these proportionality cases. It's an evolving standard. Again, I think that's common ground just about with, all the justices, save Justice Scalia and Thomas, that the cruel and unusual punishment clause has to be interpreted in light of the evolving standards of decency of a maturing society. And, of course, because it would be, if you'll pardon the expression, a dead letter if you were only limited to all those punishments, but that were no longer accepted in 1787. All right. But, of course, the court has to have a methodology for figuring out what contravenes the evolving standards of decency in a civilized society. And so they look for objective indicators in terms of how society's values, have evolved with regard to particular punishments and proportionality ideas. By looking at state laws and state practices, and then having looked at the, as they put it, objective indicia of societal standards, then exercise their independent juridical judgment about whether or not the punishment is cruel and unusual, or here, disproportionate to the seriousness of any given offense. The methodology itself is totally awkward, okay, because you'd kind of wonder, well, if a consensus has been reached, why do they have to do anything about it? And if a consensus hasn't been reached, why don't you just leave it up to the political process? And besides that, the political consensus may not have been reached. In this case, the count was there were six states that allowed it. So that meant, you know, 44 that didn't. Well, that looks like a pretty strong consensus, and that just means from the methodology you would bring the laggards in line, you know, to say that you've got to sort of, you know, fold in with the rest of the society. But on the other hand, five of those states had done it within the last 2 years, had adopted the death penalty for rape. So does this mean the consensus that used to exist is kind of unraveling? All right, put the methodological issues aside, because really, ultimately, they should be making the decision on their own anyway and stop, you know, playing as if they're counting, you know, states. So where does this bright line come from? I mean, it's elegant in its kind of biblical simplicity, right? I mean, a life for a life. But that was also true in Coker, the 1977 case. But it's problematic. I mean, the court acceded in Coker to the idea that, well, obviously there's tremendous suffering by the victim, and of course, particularly if the rape was a brutal one, certainly for a child, as Justice Kennedy said, I mean, the child has been deprived of her childhood. You know, at least if you're killed, you know, it's a moment and there's at least no suffering on your part. Obviously, lifelong suffering from the victim. So how do you quantify, you know, the degree of suffering for a person that's been victimized by a rape, particularly a brutal rape, compared to losing your life? I mean, they haven't got any way to do this, right? And so the bright line has never really been very satisfying, and particularly if you think in terms of the most aggravated, you know, forms of these cases. And Coker was perfect, because Coker actually raped his victim, tried to kill her husband, and left them for dead, right? So, and he also had a history, a horrible history of doing bad things like this. So just because they didn't die, you wouldn't give him nobody died, you wouldn't give him the death penalty. And of course, you can imagine, you know, something would be, you know, quite brutal in terms of this particular rape was, you know, very, very brutal. But you can imagine any number of aggravating circumstances that you could use to kind of narrow the cases to the most serious case, even though the person had not died. And I think anybody that thinks about this problem realizes this is not very satisfying. So there has got to be some other reason for this. And to his credit, Justice Kennedy does, in a way that Coker did not, actually identify the real problem here. The real problem is arbitrariness. He did point out that there are like at least 5,000, you know, and on a nationwide basis, there are 5,000 rapes of children under than 12. So if the states were to, you know, all create the death penalty here, how are we going to decide exactly which of the people that get the engage in child rape? It's presumably going to be a fairly small fraction of them. And how are we going to go about deciding that? Going back to Coker, I think was not mentioned, but the real issue in Coker, and there had been empirical data, is that most of the states that actually had the death penalty for rape and actually administered it were in the South. These were often, you know, black on white, you know, cases. It was really a problem of arbitrariness and racial disparities that was really at issue there. And it would be something that would be likely replicated if you actually kind of, you know, opened the door again, you know, to this. The issue here is everything that I have just said is also true about murder. Okay, to go back to the point that I made earlier. And Justice Kennedy goes into this and explains, and Justice Brennan said it earlier, but Justice Stevens, in the opinion that I mentioned earlier, goes into the continuing concerns about arbitrariness and particularly racial disparities in the administration of the death penalty. The post-Furman project has not worked. Okay, and everything that Justice Kennedy has said about what would happen if you allowed it for rape is also true with regard to the imperfections of the system that we now have. Final point here. So I think basically what Justice Kennedy is saying is we got it bad enough, okay? Do not make a bad situation worse. And the language that he uses often in the opinion is let's not expand the death penalty. which as a practical matter is what an opinion that came out the opposite would have done, because it would have invited the states to do this and just replicate all these problems, you know, for child rape. And frankly, if you opened it up for child rape, I see absolutely no way in the world that you would have to, wouldn't have to go back and reconsider Coker, right, if the states wanted to try that one also. So this would have opened up sort of a slide, you know, beyond the death penalty statutes that we now have, to open it up even further when the agenda has got to be to try to contract the death penalty, because it is a sore, you know, in our criminal justice system, and something needs to be done about it. And so I think that's the opinion that Justice Kennedy has ultimately come to have, and there's a lot of lecturing in here that has nothing to do with proportionality about the need for restraint and moderation in, you know, in our capital sentencing. And, you know, whether he, I doubt that he will go where Justice Stevens has gone, but I think you can kind of, it's a case example of what I said earlier, about the more that you look at this and you look at the, where we are, no matter where you start on that court, you migrate to the left, or at least for some people. I mean, some people, I think, are just too doctrinaire and they wouldn't do it. But I think anybody that's actually somewhere in the kind of more moderate range, you know, you just look at it and it's inevitable that you come to this view. Now, I don't know, you know, what the future is going to hold. I mean, I think I'm pretty confident that what I'm describing is an accurate description of the kind of the reality of the death penalty on the Supreme Court. So that's my view.